All right, so today we're diving into a case that revolves around construction contracts and the idea of good enough. You know, like when is something legally considered good enough?
Yeah, it's a fascinating area of the law.
It really is. And the case we're looking at today is Plante v. Jacobs,
Oh, a
the
classic.
Wisconsin Supreme Court case from 1960,
Mm
which, believe it or not, still has a huge impact on contract law today.
oh, absolutely. It's a landmark case for sure.
So to kind of set the stage for us, what exactly happened in this case?
Well, we've got a contractor, Eugene Plante, who agreed to build a house for Frank and Carol Jacobs, the price tag. A cool $26,765.
Okay.
The Jacobses made a hefty down payment and eventually moved into their new home. So far, so good,
That sounds
right?
like a happy ending.
Well, not quite. There were a few hiccups along the
I'm
way.
afraid you were going to say that.
The Jacobses started noticing some problems, some small, like some missing cabinets and some poorly installed gutters,
Okay.
and then some big ones,
Right.
like a wall that was misplaced by over a foot.
A foot. That's not exactly a minor oversight.
Nope, not at all. And because of this, their living room ended up being significantly smaller than what was in the original plans.
Wow, I could see why they'd be upset. So what happened? Did they refuse to pay the rest of the money?
Exactly. They held back the remaining balance, and Plante, being a businessman, wanted his money, so he took them to court.
And this is where things get legally interesting.
You bet. Now, the trial court actually sided with Plante. They said he had substantially performed the contract.
Substantially performed.
Yeah.
Okay.
And was entitled to the remaining payment, minus, of course, the cost of fixing those
So
defects.
hold on. Substantial performance. What does that even mean in legal terms?
It's a key concept in contract law, especially in construction cases. It basically means that even if the contractor doesn't complete every single detail perfectly, if they fulfilled the essential purpose of the contract, they've met their obligation.
So in this case, the house was still a house. It was livable, even if the living room was a tad smaller.
That's the gist of it, yeah. The court's logic was that the Jacobses got a functional house, and the core purpose of the contract was fulfilled.
I see. But I'm guessing this isn't the end of the story.
Oh, there's more. The Jacobses weren't satisfied with just getting a credit for the cost of those smaller fixes. They appealed the decision, and you know where they went.
I'm guessing all the way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
You got it. They took it all the way to the top. They argued that the misplaced wall was such a major deviation that it couldn't possibly be considered substantial performance.
It makes sense. I mean, a foot is a pretty big difference. So, how did the Supreme Court handle this whole wall debacle?
They took a very nuanced approach to the whole issue of damages.
Okay.
They drew a distinction between different types of defects and how to calculate what the contractor owed.
So break that down for us. What are these different types of defects?
Well, for minor fixable defects like the missing cabinets or the gutters, the court said the appropriate remedy was the cost of repair. Basically, how much would it cost to hire someone to fix those issues?
Makes sense. Pretty straightforward. But what about the elephant in the room? The misplaced wall. That's not a simple cost of repair situation.
Right, you're absolutely right. For more substantial defects that affect the property's value, the court uses a different measure called diminished value.
Diminished value. So how much less the house is worth because of that wall?
Exactly. But, and here's where it gets really interesting,
Okay.
the court brought in expert witnesses who actually testified that despite the smaller living room, the misplaced wall didn't lower the market value of the house at all.
Wait, what? So a $4,000 mistake to fix, but $0 in damages because the value wasn't technically impacted. How does that work?
Well, that's where this really interesting legal principle comes in, the doctrine of economic waste.
Economic waste. Okay, I'm intrigued. Tell us more.
Essentially, courts don't like to order remedies that would involve unnecessary destruction or expense if the actual value of the property hasn't been acted.
So in this case, they were basically saying, why tear down a perfectly functional wall and spend a bunch of money just to move it a foot, especially when experts say it doesn't actually hurt the house's value?
Exactly. They prioritized practicality and economic sense over a strict literal interpretation of the contract.
Wow, that's fascinating. So what was the final verdict in this epic wall saga?
The Wisconsin Supreme Court upheld the lower court's ruling. Plante, the contractor, got most of the money he was owed, minus, of course, the cost of those smaller fixable defects.
Okay, and what about the Jacobses?
Well, they got to keep living in their house, slightly smaller living room and all, but with no financial compensation for that specific issue.
So a partial victory for both sides.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
But definitely a lot to unpack in terms of legal precedent and what it means for anyone dealing with contracts.
Oh, absolutely. This case is a goldmine of legal lessons.
It really is. But before we dive into those broader implications, I'm curious, what are your initial reactions to this case? What stands out to you?
Well, I think
what's really interesting about this is like how it really emphasizes the importance of being specific in contracts. Like if the Jacobses had been more clear about, you know, the exact dimensions of their living room and how important that was to them, maybe they could have avoided this whole mess.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. That's a huge takeaway from this case. You know, Plante v. Jacobs is like a cautionary tale for anyone who deals with contracts, whether you're a contractor, a homeowner, even if you're just hiring like a freelancer for a project, specificity is key.
So let's say I'm about to sign a contract to have some work done on my house. Like, what are some key takeaways from this case that I should be thinking about?
Well, first and foremost, be crystal clear about your expectations. If there are specific things that are non-negotiable for you, spell them out. Don't just assume the other party will magically know what's important to you.
So in the Jacobs' case, they should have like specified the exact dimensions of that living room and maybe even added a clause that said any deviation from these dimensions is a material breach of contract or something.
Exactly. It's all about managing expectations up front and minimizing the risk of disputes down the line. And remember, this applies to all sorts of contracts, not just construction.
Right, so like if I'm hiring a graphic designer to create a logo and I'm super picky about the color scheme, I should be very specific about those colors. Maybe even like provide examples or color codes.
That's right. The more specific, the better. It protects both you and the other party involved.
Okay, that makes sense. Now going back to this economic waste idea, it seems like a powerful concept. But I could also see it being abused. You know, like, couldn't a contractor potentially use this doctrine to get away with shoddy work by claiming that fixing it would be economically wasteful?
It's a good question, and it's something courts are very mindful of. The economic waste doctrine isn't a free pass for contractors to do subpar work.
So how do courts determine if something is truly economically wasteful, as opposed to a contractor just trying to avoid fixing their mistake?
Well, it's a balancing act, right? They consider factors like the severity of the defect, the cost of repair, the actual impact on the property's value, and the overall purpose of the contract.
So, like, if a contractor installs a bathtub that's slightly tilted, the court might say, well, it's not ideal, but it's still functional. Ripping out the whole tub to fix a slight tilt would be overkill.
Yeah, exactly. But if the bathtub was installed so poorly that it, like, leaked and caused water damage, the court would probably see that as a more serious issue that needs to be addressed regardless of the cost.
So it sounds like they're really looking for practical solutions that are fair to both sides.
That's a great way to put it. It's not always about finding a perfect solution or punishing every little deviation. It's about considering the big picture, weighing the costs and benefits, and reaching a resolution that's reasonable and just.
You know, this whole discussion has made me think about some of my own experiences with contracts. I've definitely been on the receiving end of some work that wasn't quite what I expected, but I never even knew about things like substantial performance or economic waste.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff, isn't it? A little legal knowledge can go a long way.
Absolutely. But speaking of legal knowledge, I'm still a little fuzzy on how the Wisconsin Supreme Court justified giving the Jacobses $0 for that wall issue. Like, how did they explain that?
Okay, so you're touching on a really crucial point here. The court's reasoning was that the misplaced wall, while a deviation from the contract, didn't actually cause any financial harm to the Jacobses.
Because the expert witnesses said it didn't affect the market value of the house.
Precisely. They were basically saying, look, you got a house that's still worth what you paid for it. You haven't actually lost any money because of this wall.
Okay. But what about like a loss of enjoyment? I mean, they wanted a larger living room and ended up with a smaller one. Isn't that a form of harm?
That's a great question. And it gets to the heart of what damages are really meant to compensate for. In most contract cases, damages are focused on economic losses, actual financial harm that can be measured in dollars and cents.
So things like the cost of repairs or the difference in value if the house is worth less because of the defect.
Exactly. Loss of enjoyment or emotional distress, those are trickier. Courts are usually hesitant to award damages for those types of intangible harms in contract cases.
But isn't there an argument to be made that if you contract for something specific and you don't get it, you've suffered a loss, even if it's not purely financial?
There is, and some legal scholars argue that courts should be more open to considering these non-economic damages in certain cases. But the reality is that the law as it stands is still very much focused on these quantifiable financial losses.
I see. So even though the Jacobses might have felt cheated out of their dream living room, the court wasn't going to give them money just for their disappointment.
Right. They had to prove that the misplaced wall actually had a real measurable impact on their finances.
And since the expert witnesses said it didn't affect the market value, they were out of luck.
Yeah, essentially. Which, again, brings us back to the importance of being specific in those contracts. If they had made it crystal clear that the living room size was a deal breaker and that any deviation would have financial consequences, the outcome might have been different.
So the lesson here is, if you're entering into any contract, be as detailed as possible. Anticipate potential issues and think about what remedies you would want if things go wrong.
Absolutely. And that brings us to another interesting angle of this whole substantial performance thing.
Okay, I'm listening. What else should we be thinking about?
Well, we've been focusing a lot on the contractor side of things, but what about the other side? What does substantial performance mean for the person who's hiring the contractor or the freelancer? Does it basically give them a free pass to provide less than perfect work?
That's a really good question. I bet a lot of people are wondering that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I hire someone to do a job and they do 90% of it well, but there are some problems, can I just say, well, that's substantial performance. I'm not paying you the full amount.
No, it's not quite that simple. The substantial performance doctrine is meant to prevent one party from completely escaping their obligations under a contract just because of minor deviations or imperfections.
This is not a license for either party to be sloppy or to, you know, take advantage of the situation.
Exactly. It's about fairness, about finding that balance. The contractor is obligated to make a good faith effort to fulfill the terms of the contract, and the person hiring them is obligated to pay for the work that's been done, minus any reasonable deductions for those defects.
So it's really about both sides acting reasonably and in good faith.
That's a perfect way to put it. You know, it's about recognizing that in the real world, things aren't always perfect. But that doesn't mean the contract's automatically void or someone can just walk away from their obligations.
This whole conversation has been so eye-opening. I feel like I've learned a lot about contracts and how these kind of, like, obscure legal doctrines can actually have a real impact on everyday situations.
Me too. It really is fascinating stuff. And you know what's really important to remember is that even though we've been talking about this specific construction case, these principles apply to a wide range of contracts, from hiring a photographer to drafting a business agreement. It's all connected.
That's so true. I'm sure our listeners are thinking about how this might apply to their own lives and their own experiences.
I hope so, because ultimately the goal of understanding all of this is to help people protect themselves, you know, to navigate contracts confidently and avoid unnecessary disputes. It's about empowerment.
You know, it's amazing how a case from like 1960 about a wall can still be so relevant today.
Right. It really is a timeless legal battle.
But it got me thinking, what if things had played out a bit differently?
Ooh. Okay. I like where this is going. Hypotheticals are always fun.
So we know the Jacobses didn't get any money for that wall because it didn't affect the market value at the time. But what if, like, they sold the house a few years later?
Mm-hmm.
Could they have sued Plante then, arguing that the wall issue actually did cause them to lose money on the sale?
That's a great question, and it would definitely made things a lot more complicated.
Right. Like, imagine they sold the house for, like, I don't know, $10,000 less than comparable houses in the neighborhood, and they claim it was because of that smaller living room.
Mm-hmm.
Could they have gone back to court and been like, see, we did suffer a financial loss because of this wall?
It wouldn't be an easy case to win, that's for sure.
Yeah.
There would be a lot of legal hurdles to overcome.
I bet.
Like, for one, they'd have to prove that the smaller living room was the only reason for that lower sale price, and that's tough.
Yeah, with real estate, there's so many factors to consider.
Right. You've got changes in the market, the condition of the house, even just buyer preferences. It's not enough to just say, our house sold for less, so it must be the wall.
So they'd need some pretty solid evidence to connect that wall to their financial loss.
Exactly. They might need to bring in, like, real estate appraisers or market analysts to support their claim. And then there's also the issue of timing.
Timing? What do you mean?
Well, there are these things called statutes of limitations, which basically put a time limit on how long you have to file a lawsuit after a breach of contract.
No.
So depending on the state and the type of claim, they might have completely missed their chance to sue if they waited too long.
Oh, wow. So even if they had a really good case, they could be barred from bringing it because of a technicality like that.
That's right. Which is why it's so important to deal with these things head on, you know, as soon as they come up, rather than waiting to see what happens.
It really makes you think. This whole hypothetical situation just adds a whole other level of complexity to this case.
Yeah.
It just goes to show that contract law is not always black and white.
No, definitely not. There are always those gray areas and what ifs. It's what makes it so interesting.
And probably so frustrating for people who are actually going through these situations.
Yeah, for sure. But it also highlights why it's so important to be proactive, to think ahead and get legal advice when you're dealing with contracts, especially if there are disputes.
It also kind of goes back to what we talked about earlier, right? About being specific in contracts.
Yeah.
If the Jacobses had made it super clear that the size of that living room was a deal breaker, and that they would want compensation if it wasn't built right, maybe they would have had a better chance down the road.
Right, exactly. Clarity and specificity in contracts are so crucial. It's not about being like overly litigious. It's about protecting yourself, you know, preventing misunderstandings and disputes. It's all about being on the same page.
I think we've covered a lot of ground today.
We really have. It's been quite a journey.
From that misplaced wall to the ins and outs of substantial performance, economic waste, and even some hypothetical scenarios.
And I think our listeners have gotten a really good look at how contract law works in real-world situations. It's not just theoretical stuff in dusty law books. It affects everyone.
So I guess if we were like sum it all up,
yeah,
what would you say is the key takeaway from our exploration of Plante v. Jacobs?
I think it's this. Contracts are important. They're not just pieces of paper. They're like the blueprints for agreements. And knowing how they work, understanding those legal rules, it can really empower you to protect your interests.
Yeah.
So whether you're building a house, hiring a freelancer, or even just making a deal with a friend, take the time to understand what you're agreeing to. Be specific about what you expect, and don't be afraid to get some legal advice if you need it.
I think that's great advice for anyone.
Yeah.
Well, I think that about wraps up our deep dive for today.
It does.
But you know, the conversation doesn't have to stop here. We'd love for you to share your thoughts and reactions, or maybe even some of your own what-if scenarios on social media using the hashtag #TheDeepDive.
Yeah, we love hearing from you.
So until next time, happy contracting, everyone.